It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
And welcome to Encounter here on the Voice of America. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in this week for Carol Castiel. This week on the program, the immigration crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border. This summer, the United States has been grappling with an influx of more than 50,000 Central American children who have crossed the Mexican border, many on their own. The bulk of these unaccompanied minors are from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. They say they're seeking refuge from gang violence and poverty. Border control statistics reveal that a large number of these youngsters hail from cities like San Pedro Sula in Honduras, which has some of the highest homicide rates in the world. According to the New York Times, many of the children and parents say this new rush of migrants also stems from a belief that U.S. immigration policy offers preferential treatment to minors. Now, under a 2008 anti-human trafficking law that was passed during the Bush administration, immigrant children who are not from Mexico or Canada are given the legal right to stay in the United States until they are assigned a court date to hear their individual cases. This law was designed to prevent children being brought to the U.S. for sex trafficking and then being sent back to their home country. An unintended consequence may be that some of these Central American children now crossing the border believe that the law applies to them. Now, in the meantime, President Barack Obama has requested congressional approval for nearly $4 billion to care and process the undocumented minors. But Congress has yet to agree on the specifics of any new spending. President Obama and members of his cabinet are stressing that undocumented minors have no automatic right to remain in the United States, and they're hoping that message is heard loud and clear in Central America. The administration critics say that Mr. Obama is at least partly to blame for this border crisis, given his recently stated intention to do what he can to address America's immigration challenges through executive action. The Obama administration, along with many congressional Democrats and some Republicans, argue that the border crisis is really a symptom of the broken U.S. immigration system. Efforts to enact immigration reform have so far failed. Administration critics charge that the Obama administration should do more to enforce current laws and secure the border. Now, for more on this immigration crisis on the southern border, we're turning to two of our guests that we're happy to welcome to our Washington studio, Eric Farnsworth. Mr. Farnsworth is Vice President at the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society. That's a Washington-based organization widely considered to be a leading voice on the Western Hemisphere. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, we welcome Jerry Kammer. He's a research fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies. That's a Washington-based institute that studies the impact of immigration on American society and culture. They both join us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's begin, if we can, with the introduction that we used. I used the word crisis to describe what's going on at the U.S.-Mexican border. Mr. Farnsworth, do you think that that is the best word to describe what's happening?
I think it's certainly a word that applies. There's no question about it. The situation is desperate in some cases for the people who are coming across the border. And as you accurately said, we're dealing in some cases with children here. We've seen almost 60,000 unaccompanied minors apprehended, if you want to use that word, at the U.S. border since November of last year.
I think the most current numbers we saw are approximately 57,000 children.
That's correct.
Just in this relatively recent period.
And some of these are as young as 10 years old or even younger. And so there are a variety of reasons for this. There are circumstances that differ across different individuals, but the fact of the matter is we're dealing with individuals here. Many of them are very young. And so the circumstances of that, plus the fact that it is a real rush of new migrants, I think crisis probably does apply.
Jerry Kammer, why do you think this is happening now?
Well, we're seeing the confluence of many forces that have been building up for a number of years, and why precisely they're spiking at this moment, there's some dispute about that, but clearly we've had desperate situations in the Central American countries for a number of years. Rising violence, long-standing poverty, and dysfunctional governments unable to provide basic safety needs for their people in many instances. And I think part of the crisis of government credibility, both in Central America, but also now for our own government, because of the appearance that there is a chaotic inability of our government to establish order on that border.
The crisis at the U.S.-Mexican border is our topic this hour. We welcome Eric Farnsworth and Jerry Kammer as our guests. So, gentlemen, if I'm hearing you right, Mr. Kammer, I'm curious your thoughts as to how much you think the cause of this influx is, as many of these young children are saying, poverty and violence, and how much might it be other factors?
Well, as in most cases involving immigration, it seems to me that there are push factors pushing the people north from their home countries and pull factors drawing them into the United States. The principal push factors, it seems to me, without assigning any order, are poverty, violence. The drug trafficking has been increasing in the Central American countries, responding to demands from the U.S. market principally. Pull factors have to do with perceived economic opportunity and, I think, very importantly, the presence in the United States of the parents or other relatives of the young people who are coming across. And I should also point out that many adults are coming across. I was in the Rio Grande Valley 2 weeks ago, and I spoke with many adults from the Central American countries who also see for themselves the U.S. as their best chance to escape the poverty and violence and insecurity of their home country.
Right. And to be clear, as we've been saying here on VOA, we're talking about many of these migrants are youth, are under the age of 18, but that doesn't mean exclusively all of them are, and they're in that 57,000. Plenty of those over 18 years old also trying to come in.
There are many who are in their late teens. I saw a very interesting report on the Spanish language television earlier this week that showed a young Guatemalan mother holding a four-month-old child after they had climbed together atop the train called the Beast that travels from the Mexico-Guatemala border in various segments to the U.S. border.
Eric Farnsworth, let's talk about what may be another pull factor, at least what some critics of President Obama are saying, and that is some of his statements recently about needing to overhaul the immigration system. And if he doesn't get Congress to cooperate, well, then he's just going to take care of some of this on his own by executive action.
Well, I think perceptions certainly matter, and you can't really say that this factor or that factor is the overriding one for the entire group of people. I think that probably plays into the decisions of some people. But I think what's different about this migrant surge than previous ones, first of all, it's from Central America, not Mexico primarily. Second of all, and I think this is a very important point, we're seeing a number of unaccompanied migrants in a way that we just haven't seen before. And so to me, that says something has fundamentally changed because you're not seeing the family units migrate or whatever that you might have seen in the past. And that to me says that parents believe that the situation is so hopeless in their own home countries for their children that they're willing to put them on the Beast, or they're willing to send them with people brokers or coyotes, they're called, to get them through Mexico in a
These
very dangerous
who,
way.
These are people who shepherd.
People traffickers.
Exactly.
Yeah, and to pay a large fee to an uncertain future, and they're willing to put their children into that situation to get them to the United States. And I don't personally think that a lot of that has to do with U.S. politics in terms of the context of immigration. I think it has more to do with what they perceive as desperate situation in their hometown. It might be San Pedro Sula, as you mentioned, it might be Tegucigalpa, it might be San Salvador, or whatever it is.
Don't you think that many of the parents who are bringing the kids north, paying the smugglers, are already in the United States?
Some of them, well, you make a very good point in terms of there are family relations of many of these, and in fact, what we see in terms of patterns of migration is communities migrate to their own communities. In other words, the community of San Pedro Sula migrates to the same types of communities in the United States because there are people from that community who have already come here before, so I think it's a very important point.
Do we have any statistics that either of you have seen about how many of these unaccompanied minors have relatives in the United States and then may end up, at least for a short period of time, staying with them until they can have their hearing?
Hard statistics I have not seen, but anecdotally one hears that all the time, absolutely.
And I read a story, a Guatemalan newspaper, Prensa Libre, that quoted a government official from Guatemala saying that 97% of the Guatemalan children who are involved in this exodus are being turned over to relatives in the United States.
I think for many of our listeners in Africa and in Asia, this idea of these Central American nations being such a violent, difficult place to live may come as a surprise. Can either of you just provide some brief insights, some specifics that you can. When we talk about conditions are bad there, what are we actually saying?
Yeah, I think it's a really fair question, and we have to keep things into perspective. Central America during the 1980s and early 1990s had some brutal guerrilla wars and civil wars, and things were pretty bad there. But the difference then was that that was generally politically motivated killing. And if you were not part of that type of, if you weren't in the guerrillas or if you weren't caught up accidentally in the community, you were probably okay in terms of living your life. Now the violence is so indiscriminate that it's really affecting people where they live at the street level. It's not political. It's violence that is engendered by criminal gangs primarily and their business model, which is extortion of every business essentially, which is small business to large business, but also the fact that how do they recruit? Well, they basically press gang youngsters into the gangs. They target who they want in the gangs and then they go get them and they bring them in. In some cases, you have no ability to protect your own children. And that's what's, I think, really contributing to this phenomenon.
Jerry Kammer, is it a fair question to ask, if conditions are so bad in some of these places, is it in any way the right thing to do to be sending these children back into these very difficult situations?
Well, that's a major point of discussion and will be a major point of discussion as these asylum cases are taken up one by one in the coming months and years. That will be the big issue. Will the immigration judges grant asylum on the basis of claims that otherwise you are sending children back to very dangerous, perhaps lethal situations? Or will the immigration judges decide that most of these folks are actually economic refugees, and while that may be a poignant cause for them wanting to leave, it's not sufficient reason for us to grant them asylum?
So let's look at what the law provides for right now. There are several areas of law. One of them we mentioned earlier is, as I understand it, it's the so-called Wilberforce Act. This is the measure that was signed into law in 2008, designed to stop basically sex trafficking of young minors. But that now, unless you're coming from Mexico or Canada, the government can't simply just deport you right back. You have to have a hearing. On what basis will judges be making these decisions about whether these young people from Central America can stay?
Well, I think it's a really important point that you're raising, and each case, as was mentioned, is unique, but the fact of the matter is they are going to take some time to adjudicate and work through. But I think that the issue in terms of the Wilberforce or the legislation of 2008 is, for all the right reasons, we're getting the wrong outcome. In other words, it's the law of unintended consequences. It was passed overwhelmingly on a bipartisan basis to address sex trafficking.
Right.
But the real perversion is that you're having people traffickers take that and use it against the United States by taking advantage of those very humanitarian provisions for children and using it then to bring additional children into the United States.
And of course, there's a move afoot in Congress right now to possibly modify that act.
To amend it, right.
To amend it. Should Congress do that?
I think there's a growing feeling that this is an imperative, both a policy imperative and a political imperative. There is rising discontent within the American public about the inability of our government seemingly to establish an orderly, coherent process. But also there is great concern that these numbers are only going to increase. There is one projection that numbers next year could reach from about 60,000 this year, triple that next year, because probably the most sought after document in the world is the U.S. green card. And that's the ultimate goal, I think, of many of the people who are coming north. The green card provides a permanent residence in the United States and a path to citizenship. And that is so coveted throughout the world that if we provide an open and obvious avenue to that green card, and if the smugglers, the coyotes, can market it as something that they are guaranteed to deliver, then they seek out the Border Patrol, which is all part of the seeming craziness of the situation. Instead of the Border Patrol looking for the people, the people are looking for the Border Patrol.
And of course, it's not helped by the fact that you have a desperate population who are willing to do what they can, even taking some extreme measures to try and potentially make a run for one of those green cards. Well, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. Our guests, Eric Farnsworth, he's with the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society, and Jerry Kammer, he's a research fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies. We're talking about the humanitarian and political challenges that are posed by the growing immigration crisis along the southern U.S. border. Now, this is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online, either this episode or past episodes, as a podcast. You can do so by visiting our website, which is voanews.com/encounter. You can also follow us on Twitter if you like. That's at Carol Castiel, VOA. And of course, as always, and perhaps most importantly, we really love hearing from you. We want to hear what you enjoy hearing and what you want to hear more of on this program. That email address is encounter at voanews.com. Okay, you just threw out an interesting possibility, Mr. Kammer, and Eric Farnsworth, I'm interested in both your thoughts. If the numbers, say, reach perhaps about 60,000 migrants, border crossers, in this relatively recent period, and we're seeing the difficulties that it's posing for many communities along the southern U.S. border, well, if that number could potentially increase by a factor of 3, what would that mean for the United States? I mean, I think that would have to so profoundly change the dialogue in this country about immigration and how people see it and embrace it or not.
Well, I think that's exactly right. Of course, it's purely speculative. We don't know what's going to happen in the future.
Right.
But this is something that's been going on for more than just a couple months. I mean, we talk about 60,000 or 57,000 since November. But if you look at the trend line over the past couple of years, it's certainly been increasing. And it didn't just start in November. So this is something that will presumably continue. But I think, having said that, people are focused on the issue now at a federal level, at a state level, and recognize that if it gets much worse, it's going to be a significant problem. And so I think they're going to have to take steps to try to make sure.
Jerry Kammer?
Yeah, Doug, I'm concerned that if this flow continues to grow and continues to be unmanageable, it's going to do great damage to what I think of as a social contract involving immigration. And by that, I mean the idea of a mutual obligation whereby the immigrants want to be part of us and we want to embrace them and help them become integrated into our society. If you read immigration history, some scholars have warned in the past that unless order were established, there would be a public reaction that could become xenophobic and angry. We are seeing the beginnings of that now. People are frustrated, angry at the government, and in many instances are rejecting not just the government, but our policy.
I see some of that. I'm wondering, though, how much it might be, for lack of a better term, being stoked up a little bit by various individuals or organizations who have an interest in perhaps kind of turning up the volume on this topic. Eric Farnsworth?
There's this famous saying that is accredited to a former chief of staff of the White House, don't let any crisis go unattended. And I suspect there is some of that going on. But let's not forget, I mean, we're dealing with human beings here. We're dealing with some desperate situations.
Right.
Some people will seek to take political advantage from both the left and the right. That's probably par for the course. But I think if we keep focused on what the actual problem is, it will help us find better solutions.
And I think we have to have a short-term view. In the short term, we have to take care of these children. I mean,
yes.
I think that's a basic human necessity. We have to respond to the needs of fearful, isolated, hungry children. In the long term is the big, difficult question. Should we grant them the right to stay in the United States by the tens, potentially hundreds of thousands? And how would that affect the rest of our immigration panorama?
I think many people are curious about this particular point. How exactly are these children going to be taken care of, sheltered, fed, and cared for over what may be a process that lasts 6 months, a year, perhaps longer?
Well, and I think there is a basic humanitarian impulse, as has been mentioned, whether it's by the state or by the church or by families many are going to. And I think that is a reality, and homes need to be found. But at the same time, then there's a certain moral hazard, too, because if people can come to the states and know that their situation is going to be very welcoming and comfortable and all that, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be, but if that's the perception, then the pull factor that we talked about is probably intensified. So you have to strike a balance here, and I think this is the most difficult part.
Yeah.
Those of us who are deeply concerned about the individuals recognize that at the same time, while we're taking care of them as a compassionate society, we do not want to create conditions that will unduly bring in additional populations who,
right,
frankly, might be coming here under false pretenses, which is to say they may think that they have the ability to stay or that through immigration reform there's going to be a long-term acceptance of massive new population flows. And so there's a real balance we have to strike.
Yeah, that is a great concern on Capitol Hill and among the American public, that if word gets out around the world that if you can get across our border, and you're, especially if you're a needy child, you will be allowed to stay for an indefinite period while we review your case. The fear is we will be swamped, and we cannot allow that to happen.
The president has been fairly clear, at least in his statements on this particular subject, that no, the doors are not simply open. No, you are not guaranteed entry into the United States. This is not, if you can make it here, you can come on in. I wonder about the efficacy of kind of preventing this. If we don't want to just keep accepting for fear that it's going to really kind of unwind the system, is then deporting these children back to their home nations the most effective way to combat it?
I think, again, there's a short-term and a longer-term issue here. In the short term, we have to deal with the population of folks who are coming here and have to be handled in a certain way. But I think the longer-term response is to try to stem the flow of folks coming in the first place. And how do we do that, particularly in the Northern Triangle countries of Central America, the Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, which you mentioned earlier? These are countries which are in desperate need of assistance. Now, I'm not necessarily talking about foreign assistance and massive Marshall Plans and things like that, but there are some basic things that the United States and, frankly, others in the international community, like Mexico, like Colombia, like others, can be able to assist with in a way that will begin to address some of these push factors so that the situation isn't as desperate and the desire isn't as acute to get out of those local circumstances and get to the next best circumstance that they could anticipate, that might be the United States. So I think as we're dealing with the immediate crisis on the ground in the United States, and we do have to deal with that, at the same time, we need to be working very diligently to try to stem the flow of new populations of folks coming from the northern part of Central America, or frankly, wherever they might be coming from.
Eric, what do you think we have the right to demand of the Central American governing elites?
You read my mind.
Yeah, you know, I think that is a very fair question, a very appropriate question. And governing elites and, frankly, the business elites, I think, need to do more. I think there is a question of basic governance in Central America. You raised it earlier, Jerry, and I think that that's appropriate. I think that takes resources in some cases that can be raised by the private sector in Central America, taxation, etc. But I think there's also a basic social compact that needs to be made, which is to say that traditionally in Central America, there has been a view that the elites take care of themselves and everybody has to fend for themselves. That can't work anymore. In the United States, we don't have that type of view. There's always been a view that we're in this together. Now, we can argue the specifics of that one way or the other. But in Central America, I think there needs to be a much bigger effort at social consciousness, particularly among the governing and business elites.
If I may, what about another potential major partner in addressing this, and that's the nation of Mexico? What are they doing or not doing, at least at this point, from what you're hearing regarding this situation?
Well, one thing the government has announced this week is that it is going to stop migrants from Central America from boarding the train called the Beast, which in various segments is estimated to bring annually about 200,000 people from Central America to our borders, where they're exposed on this long route, about 1,500 miles, to all sorts of dangers, from falling off the train and being amputated to being extorted, raped, abused, and shaken down by very corrupt Mexican authorities, as well as the criminal gangs. It has been a national scandal in Mexico. The Mexican government saying it is going to act, and I'm going to be very interested to see if they follow through.
Well, we're looking at about, as we were saying, 50,000 or so border crossings in this recent surge. How many legal immigrants are allowed entry into the United States approximately each year?
It's about 1 million that we give green cards to. Many of them actually are already here. They adjust their status, as it's called, but we confer about 1 million green cards every year.
So now I understand the serious need to get help to these young people who are now in the United States, but 60,000 out of approximately 1 million does not seem to me to be an undue burden on a system that's already processing a fair number of people each year. What am I missing here?
One thing I would say you're missing is the additional cost, for example, for the school systems that in some instances have dozens, and I think in Lynn, Massachusetts, a couple of hundred young people from Guatemala showing up in their schools, sometimes in the middle of the year, in their teenage years, unable to speak English. And Lynn is already in financial difficulty, and the mayor there is screaming for help, saying, we don't know how to deal with these people.
In addition to, I suppose, the burdens put on local health care systems and all kinds of situations. Yeah. Eric Farnsworth, what are your thoughts as to how often? A lot of these children are going to be placed somewhere. They will be in a home. Someone will be caring for them. How often do these children simply get lost?
There seems to be a high percentage of children that, as you say, get lost from the system.
And that's not meant to be a callous statement.
But no, but you know, the reality is there's only a finite amount of resources that even the United States government can apply to any of these, and the most egregious cases are going to be the ones that are looked at first. So the reality is a lot of kids, if they get into the country through the system, and again, through the legislation and the generosity of the American people, through the court system, the pragmatic implication is that they actually will be able to stay for a short period or even a longer period of time. And this is an issue that really needs to be looked at. If this is what we want to have happen, that's fine. But if it's not what we want to have happen, we need to find ways to change it in some way.
And I do think that many people in Central America realize that they are pushing the limits of the U.S. ability to deal with the situation. Again, on Spanish language news last week, I saw a reporter interview a man from Honduras who had come across illegally with a child and was being released. And he was asked, what is your message to the government of the U.S.? And this man from Honduras said, well, my message is thank you and excuse us for invading the country. So there is a recognition that this influx has assumed such dimensions that it's beginning to feel overwhelming to a lot of people.
There are obviously a lot of questions that are at this point simply unanswerable. We'll have to see how this situation evolves over time. As we move toward closing this out, for both of you, and first to you, Mr. Farnsworth, how do you think this has affected the broader discussion and debate about reforming the U.S. immigration system as a whole?
If press reports are to be believed, we probably weren't going to have an immigration reform this calendar year anyway, or at least before the U.S. midterm elections. And so that probably goes back to next year at the earliest. But the point that you're making, I think, is a valid one, which is to say there are going to be increasing calls, and there are increasing calls to say before you try to reform the immigration system itself, you have to make sure that the border itself is secure. We're hearing that. I think that will play into it.
Fundamentally, immigration reform involves a compromise. One side gets more immigration, the other side gets more control, regulation of future immigration. What is happening now with this uncontrolled influx into our country is great damage is being done to the appearance of our ability to establish control. And unless there is confidence in the ability of our government to regulate future immigration, certainly the chances of passing any sort of compromise reform bill are going to be damaged terribly.
Thanks so much to our two guests joining us today, Jerry Kammer, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies, and Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the Americas. Thank you for your insights on this issue. Thanks also very much to our staff here producing Encounter, Anya Zalewski, Katie Espolita, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Carol Castiel. Carol will be with you next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.